Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You know, in the olden days when they made these films, they used to make money by selling tickets. But that's not how we make our money, is it, Duncan?
No. How do we make our money, Rob?
I have absolutely no idea, Duncan, but apparently it would really help if people liked, subscribed, and left 5-star reviews. Welcome to A Pod Too Far, the place for people who know that war films got worse once John Mills retired. I'm Rob Hutton, and this week I'm just trying to hold the podcast together in the hell that is a Japanese prisoner of war camp. That's right, we're watching King Rat. Helping me, but possibly plotting to put me in his cage, is a chippy northerner with ideas of overthrowing the ruling class. Hello, Duncan Weldon.
Hello, Rob.
So, Duncan, this was your pick. Why?
Okay, so I think to start with, I looked back at what we'd done so far, realised we hadn't done anything in the Far East. It'd all been Europe, North Africa, at sea. I thought we should do a Far East film. If you're going to do a Far East film, the obvious first one to go for is Bridge Over the River Kwai. But that's sort of too obvious. So delving into the back catalogue, I remember King Rat existed. Now, this is a film, I think I'd seen it twice before I watched it again this week. I saw it once on television when I was much younger. I watched it again about 15 years ago, and I think it's a fantastic film, and I also think it's quite an unusual war film, but still within our broad remit.
Yeah, totally.
You hadn't seen it, had you?
I'd never come. I mean, I was aware of its existence, and I mean, the other thing that you said to me when you were pitching this one was, it's a James Clavell film, and along with there always being war films on a Sunday afternoon, my memory of the 1980s is that any holiday cottage you went into had a James Clavell book.
Yes, my grandfather's bookshelf had a lot of James Clavell on it. And yeah, he was a very, very big author in the 70s and 80s, wasn't he?
Yeah, although I would have, I mean, I associate him, I would just say James Clavell's house, which I've no idea what that's about, but it's all, I think of him as sort of writing films about Japanese.
Yeah, so his novels, they're almost entirely sort of historical novels set in Asia. So House is like a very likely fictionalized account of the Keswick family who ran Hong Kong for many, many years and still in some ways do. So, you know, it's like Noble House and all of that. There was a series of novels about samurai.
I think they're remaking Shogun. Saw an IMDb. I'm quite excited about that.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm curious they were. So
I might be up for that.
I mean, the thing about the novels is he's sort of like an earlier version of Tom Clancy in some ways. You know, they're very easy to read, very, very big. And you know, I read one 5 or 6 years ago, and they're thoroughly entertaining reads, if you accept they were written by a British man in the mid-20th century who had a slightly different attitude towards Asia to maybe a modern writer might have.
Well, let's talk about what might have coloured James Clavell's attitude towards Asia and the Japanese in particular. He's born in 1921. He's the son of a Royal Navy officer. War breaks out. He joins the artillery. He's trained for the desert, but then Pearl Harbor happens, and instead, he's sent to Singapore.
Which doesn't go well for the British Army.
Which doesn't go well, but he doesn't even get, I think, to Singapore because his ship is sunk on the way.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to quote, read from Wikipedia. They're picked up by another ship. Their commander, described by Clavell years later as a total twit, insisted that they be dropped off at the nearest port to fight the war despite having no weapons.
Nah, we've already got the stiffest upper lip. It's right. The screenwriter. I mean, there's no screenwriter's commanding officer.
I did actually try to do quite a lot of research, and I never found out how he gets shot in the face, but he gets shot in the face. He gets captured, and ends up in Changi, which is where King Rat is set.
Yes, it is. It is. And later, where Nick Leeson was. Imprisoned after bearings a little bit. I think it was a slightly worse place in the 1940s than in the 1990s.
And it is, I mean, it's hell.
Yes.
So at the point at which this film comes out, as you say, Bridge on the River Kwai has done prisoner of war camp hell in the Far East. Yeah. I think this makes it look hellisher, actually. Mm. Diet was a quarter of a pound of rice, which I actually measured that out today. It's about 100 grams. It's about half a cup of rice a day.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that's dry rice, actually. If it was wet, it's less than that if it's wet rice. And one egg a week.
Yeah.
A lot of people died.
Yes. And you really see the contrast in, you know, films like this and Bridge of the River Kwai compared to, you know, Great Escape and, you know, sort of the RAF men in... German prisoner of war, Escape from Cold. It's all of that sort of stuff. They're very, very different films.
Well, when we did The Great Escape, I think I said to you, it just looks like being brilliant fun being in a prisoner of war camp, doesn't it?
Yes, it's like being in a certain type of school, yes.
And this does not look like brilliant fun. Though, do you know who wrote The Great Escape?
Go on.
James Clavell.
I did not know that.
Yeah. But he's one of three screenwriters, so I don't know how much of his stuff makes it to the page. But
a prisoner of war camp, lads. I'll tell you what a prisoner of war camp is like.
Because after the war, he becomes... he's a really interesting story. After the war, he goes to university, sort of becomes a screenwriter, mm-hmm. sort of slightly by accident, writes The Fly, the mm-hmm. original one. And, I mean, his wife knows he's carrying this trauma.
Yes.
And he, for 15 years, he doesn't talk about what's happened to
him. It's 4 years in the camp for him, isn't it?
So, But I mean, there were clues. So all this time, he is always carrying a tin of sardines with him.
Yeah.
And apparently sort of is staving off the urge to go and rummage in bins for food. I was trying to explain this to my kids the other day in the context of why it annoys older people when they leave food on their plates.
Yes, and
I said, well, you've got to remember, if you grew up in rationing, there's this very strong can't leave food on the plates thing. I think that if you spent 3-4 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp...
Quarter of a cup of rice a day, an egg a week,
you'd multiply that by 1,000. That clearly stays with you.
But you can see it in this film and in the screenplay. I think it's a great screenplay.
Yeah.
But you know, he's taken an already hellish environment and he's made it more hellish with the characters.
I don't think I have seen hunger... Mm-hmm. done better.
Yeah.
All of these scenes where people are watching someone eat or smoke and it just goes tight on their faces and they're licking their lips and it's pornographic or something. Yeah. You know, there's this sort of the total lust and desire to have something you can't have. It's a brilliantly done. So
They say, you know, write what you know, and what he knew was 4 years in this hellish environment.
But he can't talk about it for a long time. Yes. And then there is a writer's strike, amazingly. And because there's a screenwriter's strike, he's not allowed to write screenplays. So he writes a novel, and his wife essentially, I think, sort of tells him to go and write what happened to him. And King Rat is his novel, which is a loose fictionalization of his life in Changi. It's set in Changi. Sells quite well. Gets made into a film. So it comes out in 65, which is 2 years after The Great Escape, same year as Von Ryan's Express.
Yeah. It's always worth remembering we're 20 years after the war at this point.
Yeah, we talk a lot, I think, and a lot of films are made about, as it were, the war in the West, which is more straightforward, it feels, in some ways. Yeah. And, well, okay, my mum would not buy a Japanese car.
Yes, my granddad, who was 14 farming in Burma, I can't imagine him in a Japanese car.
No, because my great uncle, who she'd never met, she was born in 45, but her great uncle died in a Japanese camp, and an absolute article of faith in her side of the family is that he need not have died in a Japanese camp, if you see what I mean. And which was very traumatic for her mother, my grandmother, who, you know, was still talking about it quite late in life. And in this generation, in people who are watching this, there clearly is still a memory of just how awful this was, and that goes beyond the people who were there.
Yes, and lots of them were there for a very long time. So, you know, sort of for Singapore, Malaya, all of that. You know, these people spending 3-4 years in, and much larger numbers, I believe, than in the West as well.
Yes, probably. Yes, because I suppose whole armies are captured, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, and of course, the point at which land armies are fighting in the West, I mean, apart from the Desert War, the point at which land armies are fighting is much later. There's just less time.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, broadly, Allied troops are not getting captured.
Yeah.
From 44 to 45, because they're sort of moving forwards. Yeah, so whereas the sort of the jolly pilots having terrific fun, you know, tunnelling out of Stalag Luft 3 is, whereas here you've got, you know,
and there's no Switzerland to run away to either. Yeah. If you do get out.
Well, I mean, so there's the start of the film that just says, you know, you can't escape.
Yeah.
There's the jungle.
Yeah.
Which is a direct echo of Bridge on the River Kwai when they're greeted and the commandant says, "You will see here, there is no wire. Because where are you going to go?"
Yeah.
You know? I mean, for those who haven't seen it, briefly, it's really just a sort of a series of episodes in early 1945 about the relationship between Marlowe, who is a British officer, a British pilot, who's clearly a sort of a cipher for Clavel, and King, who Corporal King, who's a how are we describing him? He's an American hustler, really, isn't
exactly,
he?
Exactly. Yeah. And this is the thing: this is a prison movie, not a war movie, in many ways, and it's about, you know, relationships of different people in prison. And King is he's a hustler. He's a sort of proto-mobster in some ways, isn't he? And it,
I think in the novel, which I haven't read, I think he might be softer edged. I think that in the novel, there's a sense that something you get a bit of a picture of in the film, which is that he is actually, he is looking out for other people. But he is the one man who looks well fed.
Yes, yes.
You know, because he's worked out how to game the system. Yeah. He's worked out the cracks, which are the guards to talk to.
Yeah. He's almost living well, almost, I think. Yeah. You know,
Yeah, and there's this great sort of opening sequence where you get the constant juxtaposition of you know, massively emaciated British officers and this chap having a sort of a wet shave and his fingernails buffed and all of this kind of thing, and lighting a cigarette and then discarding it without having smoked it all the way down, you know, so that somebody else comes and runs and picks up the butt.
Yeah.
So this is a film about survival, and it's a film about class. And it's a film about Brits and Americans.
Yeah. And was it British made or American made?
Well, it's made in California. Yeah. It's an American film with a large British cast.
Yes.
Many of whom are on their way, are already stars or are on their way to becoming stars, including James Fox, by the way.
Yeah.
Is this his best role? This might be his best role. Father of Lawrence. Father-in-law of Richard Ayoade. imagine that Christmas at the Fox household is always interesting. Let's go to the after-action report. So, Quick Dad, they're on the cable car. I don't feel this is a film where you want to be called in. It's not...
No, it's not a war film with action sequences and so forth. It's a film about atmosphere, about tension, essentially about the compromises people make to stay alive.
I picked out sort of four scenes, two of which I put together, though they're separate. The first is the frying the egg scene.
Yeah.
You get Marlowe and you get the Provost Marshal and you get King... Yeah. Together, you get all... I mean, it's a scene that could be a play.
Mm. I mean, lots of this film would work as a play, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very...
Yeah, you could put this on stage with no difficulty at all, actually, couldn't you? Yeah.
I mean, the special effects budget wasn't stretched for this film.
Partly you've got the hunger, but you've also, even though Marlowe is watching King, you know, and you can see him salivating, and he can't believe he's being offered an egg, and he can't believe that there's nothing... At the same time, there is this weird thing that he is a gentleman.
Yes.
And somehow he can't bring himself to as he says, kiss thee on the arse.
Yes.
He can't bring himself to do what he sort of suspects ought to be done.
Yeah, from someone who is lower class and not an officer and American. And all of this together, it's the deadly trio.
The thing about that is at one level, that's the kind of class snobbery attitude that I think we're generally supposed to find contemptible.
Yeah.
But actually, with Marlowe, you sort of think maybe this is what's keeping him alive.
Yes.
At some level, is his just ability to know that...
He is clinging on to a part of himself. And that's,
yes,
that's
yeah.
what's holding
well,
him together.
That's it, yeah. exactly. He knows that really he sort of belongs strolling through the grounds of his father's very large house in Shropshire or something. Mm-hmm. That all of this that's happening to him, that's not real. This isn't real.
Yeah.
That's real. And I guess it's that ability to hold on to that.
Yeah. And this is fundamentally the point of the film, that it's a study in people and how they cope. It's not an action film. It's not a...
Thanks. I absolutely love the Provost Marshal.
Go on.
The other thing about war films, and actually I find, particularly with prisoner of war films, because they sort of have these archetypes, like The Great Escape. Mm-hmm. You sort of sit there and think, well, who would I be?
Yes.
You know, who am I in this film? Yeah. I mean, I'm clearly not the American.
No.
You know,
I'd be the man diving for the discarded cigarette. but
there is a part of, you know, there is a part of me that is the guy who's just saying, well, look, we all ought to stick to the rules.
Yeah.
You know, there is definitely a part of me that feel, you know, that we have to maintain order.
Yeah.
And who resents people who he knows are breaking. There's a massive part of me who resents people. And and there's obviously another part.
It's like when
of
you see someone driving in a bus lane, isn't it?
But on a much
worse scale.
just who the hell do you think you are? And there is another part of me that's the Tony Marlowe posho.
Yeah.
Though we didn't have a nursery either. I mean, I feel I should make clear at this point. And it's interesting, actually, that King can't quite navigate that. And one of the reasons why he likes Marlowe at some level is because Marlowe isn't sucking up to him.
Yes.
And there are, spoiler, there are no women in this film. but I don't think it's supposed to be a romance between Marlowe and King, but there is a little bit of, I want the one I can't have.
Yes.
The one person here who is not...
Isn't playing the game that everyone else is. Yeah.
It obviously sort of fascinates him.
Yeah.
I've got the eating the dog scene.
Yeah. My children walked in during that scene.
Oh, no.
But I mean, utterly horrified. So, you know, if you're going to pick a scene to call someone in that one, especially if they're quite young.
But it's well done.
It is.
Because it's the flip side of that hunger. And it's the argument, should we eat the dog? It's not just like eating any dog. This is a dog that we knew.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, maybe Alive does debating whether you eat your cousin better, but I sort of, it's good. And also, it's all the scenes that Leonard Rossiter is in.
Yes.
Leonard Rossiter.
It's just phenomenal in this, actually. And I think of Leonard Rossiter as, you know, Rigby as not as...
He can't quite be Rigsby from here, but he could be Reginald Perrin. This might have been what Reggie Perrin was doing 10 years ago. Yeah, well, we'll come back to Leonard Rossiter, I suspect. But and the third one is sort of two scenes. It's good John Mills at the radio search, and it's bad John Mills with the food theft.
Yeah, John Mills playing the John Mills character. It must be said.
But John Mills playing the posh John Mills character.
He's got two. He's got two. We've done them both. We have four times each.
I think we'll get them both again. This is a layered John Mills character, because when you first see him, I thought, oh, moral heart.
Yeah.
You know, here is John Mills, who's clung on and he's looking hungry, but he's here to stand up for what's right and what's wrong. And then he's not. He's not.
No,
you know.
This is one of the great bits about the film, I think. It's just, you know, it's what presumably by this point years in this camp has done to people.
Earlier, about a third of the way in, there is a scene in which one of the men is accused of stealing food and he denies it.
Yeah.
And he is then killed, effectively. Killed definitely by, there's no doubt about that. Do we actually think that it's the officers who have been stealing the food at this point? And they are we supposed to think that?
I think we probably are. I think we probably are.
Right.
I think this is yet more ways of the Orphic level talking about, you know, what must have been some fairly horrific memories.
Yeah.
You know, in 20 years to deal with them.
I think from the novel, from what I read about the novel, I think that it is. And actually, that's why when they're then eating rat at the end, it's supposed to. And I don't think this quite works in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, you basically enjoy every time you see them smiling because they don't smile very much. But in the in the book, it's much more, this is justice.
Yeah.
These officers who have been, the senior officers who have been stealing the food and have let someone else, you know, take the rap for it. Are eating rat.
Yeah.
You know, then, yeah, it's
I mean, you know, I think I'd go rat over the dog.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's sitting there, half a cup of rice and one egg a week. I would have no problem eating that. That's sort of, is it protein? I mean, you know, they're eating worse things, I think, when they're grinding up the insects or whatever. I'd eat rat.
I mean, I'd eat rat is my takeaway from this discussion so far. Not even in a camp, just bring me rat.
There are no women. The body count is 3-4 if you count the dog.
Yes. But that comes back to this point, doesn't it? This isn't a typical war film. I mean, that must be one of the lowest body counts we've encountered so far.
On that line, the best death. I think it really sort of has to go to Colonel Davin, who's the one who's killed over the radio.
Yes.
And we don't exactly discover what it is that happens to him between him being led away and him being in a bed that evening about to die, but it's nothing good.
No.
And you just get a little slice of him earlier on where he's saying, praying, please God, let me be brave.
Yes.
Please God, let me be brave. And then he is brave.
Yeah.
You know, and so he's sort of, he hath his goodness now.
Yes. Yeah. And he is also, and I think there is a bit of sort of the author in there that he's, you know, he's received his way out of this situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I do like to think, because who the same actor goes on to play?
Go on.
He's the vicar in The Eagle Has Landed.
Is he?
And I quite like the idea that Colonel Davin doesn't actually die and just goes and takes holy orders in Norfolk.
Yes,
he's standing up to Michael Caine.
Yeah. Fair.
On the subject of which, did you recognise the Doctor?
I didn't. Go on.
The Doctor.
See, I deliberately avoid looking at IMDb after I've watched one of these. Because
so I can
as a test of have I spotted this. And I think about a third of the time I've spotted this, and often I haven't because it's a minor character in 1980s television.
He is a minor character in 1980s television. But so the actor is James Donald, who may have looked familiar as a doctor in a Japanese prisoner of war camp because he's the doctor in Bridge on the River Kwai.
And
may also have looked familiar because he's the senior British officer in The Great Escape. So I've sort of got this idea that there's a kind of James Donald extended universe where he's moving, where he's been on the River Kwai and now he's here.
Yeah.
And maybe got sent here after The Great Escape. It's not exactly clear. Sort of.
Try and escape. We'll send you to a much worse camp.
Talking to our friends, the Japanese. I mean, there are no gratuitous American characters in this.
No.
You need King to be an American character.
You need King
to be an American because you sort of need someone to look in on the British relationships.
Yes.
And I mean,
out of interest, have you got any idea how this film went down in the States? To me, it's a very British film.
It sort of does all right, and it gets nominated for a cinematography award.
Yes.
I mean, Clavell felt that it had flopped, and he thought that they'd flopped because they'd sort of cut too much of the stuff from the book. And various critics feel that it's sort of episodic rather than a straight narrative.
There's some fairness in that.
Yeah. No, totally. I have to say, I watched it twice in the space of a week because having watched it, I was just like, well, I'm going to watch that again. That's really good.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, you know, when you think about it, I think it's probably the only film we've done where I can imagine it working as like a 10-part television show.
Yes.
Well, give it the 10 hours to breathe and
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true, actually, because you could do much more with it. You're right. So this, Netflix.
Yeah, there you go. Can't be that expensive.
Other British actors who are on the cusp of greatness. Tom Courtney as the Provost Marshal is just amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, doesn't go on to be a movie legend because he prefers acting on the stage. Yeah. But you can completely see why at this point, you know, there are lots of people are saying the world is his oyster.
Yeah.
And Leonard Roster.
Absolute
star.
And it surprised me. It surprised me because I think of him as a sitcom actor or as a slightly dark tone sitcom in some ways at times. But But yeah, it's just a great performance.
Not massively far, in a sense, from those characters.
Yes.
But maybe those characters in a different different situation. Yeah. But I don't really think it's a meme film. I think you put a meme up from the... I mean, you could have people salivating.
You could.
You could have a salivating supercut. But
there are some great quotes in it, but again, I don't think they're memeable.
No. I like I'm not in your two-bit army, I'm in our two-bit army.
Yes, I do. I like the, you know, don't be a snob, can't be a policeman if you're...
Don't be a snob if you're a policeman, says the snobbiest character in the film at one level, but who's also... He's so posh that he's kind of gone to the other side where he can he cannot be posh again, you know, or
I
not be
the,
a snob.
I love the sort of Anglo-American language about the egg. And, you
know, No. Well, when we... I've got that here. When we say not bad, we don't mean not bad. We mean it's bloody marvellous.
Yes.
Yeah, well, what do you mean when you say it's bloody marvellous? Bit dicey.
Yes.
So, I sort of imagine is what he said just before he was shot down.
Yeah.
So, stiffest upper lip. Well, I mean, obviously you've got James Clavell's senior officer. I've got, and I couldn't find his name, but the officer whose dog dies.
Yes.
Not, I mean, he's not stiff upper lip at the time, but afterwards when he's saying, oh, it's probably for the best.
Yes. You know?
And James Fox can't look at him because he's eaten it. Sort of funnier in retrospect, I think, than it was in the moment.
Right at the time, yes, yeah.
I mean, no Nazis in it. There's one nasty Japanese officer, essentially Yoshima, who spends his life, so far as I can tell, playing chaps like this in films like this.
Yeah.
Any problematic moments? I don't. I mean, dog eating is obviously not something you'd want your children to walk in on, but it's not.
No, but it's not. It's not like
they didn't know what it meant at the time. And again, no completely implausible moments. I mean, it's the Broadsword Radio Award for completely implausible moments. I do want to know where they were getting their radio parts from.
Yes.
But I sort of assumed that he wrote that because that happened. Yeah. And I haven't... Actually, funnily enough, I'm reading Helen Zweig's book about MI9 at the moment, but I don't know how much she talks about the Far East.
Yeah.
But whether they were being sent parcels that sort of contained some of this stuff, and that's how they you feel, or maybe they were trading it with the guards. Judgment at Nuremberg. How many war crimes are committed in this film, Duncan?
Well, I mean, the entire treatment of the prisoners. The premise of the film is he was a war crime. Let's see how it affects people. So, I mean, the Geneva Convention rule is you have to give the same rations to your prisoners as you give to your own army.
Right, yes.
And, you know, I doubt the Japanese soldier was surviving on one egg a week and half a cup of rice.
It's really not very much. I mean, seriously, weigh out 110 grams of rice and think, you know, and then you can understand, you understand why people stealing it, you know, if you're stealing 10 grams of rice is such a big deal or whatever, both to do it and not to do it. I mean, how much did they make up? We don't think, in a sense, that they made very much up of it at all. This feels broadly like if these specific things didn't happen, this was what it's like.
It's sort of a flavour of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's better than Bridge on the River Kwai for that.
Yeah.
Almost because Bridge on the River Kwai has got more of a story and so on. We will definitely do Bridge on the River Kwai.
But I think Bridge on the River Kwai, it is a film with a plot which is set in a prisoner of war camp.
Yeah.
Whereas this, the plot is the prisoner of war camp in some ways and how people cope with it.
Is this the operation that changed the course of World War II?
No, just a very, very miserable one for a...
Yeah. It's just a sort of a sad and horrible and miserable thing that happened. Yeah. Worth dying for.
I think it's a fantastic film. I would go as far as to say it is possibly the best film that we've discussed so far as a film to watch. And I was surprised. It's not a fun film in some ways, but it's just a great piece of cinema, a great piece of writing, some great performances.
Yes. I don't know that I would disagree with that. As I say, I watched it twice. I would watch it again. I mean, it's sort of... My son did watch some of it with me and actually probably was more interested by it because it is about character rather than sort of trying to watching people try to take a bridge or something. It is just about people and people in a horrible situation. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, should be in the iPlayer rotation.
I think we should clearly read the novel now as well.
Yes. It's actually the only... I've never felt the urge to read one of the sort of the Japanese doorstops, but I would quite like to read this one. But. Right. Well, the campaign to get King Rat shown every Christmas begins here.
I'm going to say one thing. It is not a Christmas film.
Okay.
We can debate Die Hard. We can debate whatever. This is absolutely not your Boxing Day watch. Well, you're sitting there after a big dinner. Like, what do I watch now? And I'm filled with starving people eating a dog. I don't know what Christmas is like in your house, Rob.
A dog is not just for Christmas in our house. Thanks for listening. Next week, we're off in search of gold with Kelly's Heroes.